News time now, 8:19, and joining me on the phone, I've got a member of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, Melina Stevens. Good morning, Melina.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you got to the meeting in the middle of that discussion for the Autism Elevation Group home. You did vote in favor of it. Why did you think this is a good project?
Well, I agree with other comments that were made that we, in Park City in general, in Snyderville Basin specifically, we want to be inclusive. We want to make sure that we're taking care of the needs of all of our residents. And also with the conditions that were imposed, it was very, very reasonable and very, we believed that we were able to mitigate it.
On the Old Ranch Road Estate subdivision, this is a property of about 200 acres. There'll be 8 single-family lots and an affordable housing duplex. Some occasional comments from planning commissioners to the effect of, is this contributing to affordable housing? What was your take on that?
You know, I mean, there is in the code that they have to contribute some sort of affordable housing unit. There's a whole formula that is used. I believe it's 20%. So with that, and if the person is living on site and continuing to work there, I think that it's adding some diversity to the neighborhood. Is it taking care of our overall issues that we currently have? Maybe, maybe not. I think that if we may be importing somebody there that perhaps doesn't already live in Park City at the time.
Yeah, so how many units were we talking about? Just two? It's a duplex, so two?
Yeah.
Okay.
Both sides of the duplex, from what I understand.
Okay. Let's see. Commissioners also talked about affordable housing on the next project, the Village at Silver Summit. This is near Burt Brothers there at near Silver Creek. It's a 5-building, mixed-use project, some 208,000 square feet, 50 residential units, retail and office. At issue here is the applicant is satisfying his affordable housing obligation with a fee in lieu payment of $3 million. Some of the planning commissioners are a bit frustrated by this, but it is allowed. And the applicant, Robert Holmes, said that the county puts up obstacles to affordable housing, and he was denied the chance to add an extra story to his project to make it happen. So how do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I really appreciate efforts that people provide to increase affordable housing. I think that with the way that the code is currently written, that perhaps the fees are a little more appealing to some applicants because building a bunch of affordable units can be costly. But I think that with the need that is here, and when we're trying to build these mixed use neighborhoods and trying to reduce traffic, and that's all part of it. If we don't have people that are living on site, that are actually working in the facility, I think that that's probably going to increase some of the traffic and not take us to the point where we're trying to get to.
So you would have liked to see it on site, but you didn't agree with adding a story to one of the buildings to make that happen.
In our discussions with this story, it wasn't approached that way when we made that determination. It was brought up at this meeting.
Okay, but in terms of just the issue of, I mean, whether or not if we want it, do we need to make exceptions for affordable housing?
Well, with that, that would be a broader discussion we would have to have, make sure that the code would allow for something like that, and perhaps have some discussions with, some discussions amongst ourselves during our planning commissioner comment section.
Okay.
Trying to make a determination to pass some sort of code change to council to approve.
Let's see. The last item was a work session item on Bittner Station. This also seemed to touch on some broad issues. 4 acres near the fire station there on Bittner Road and Canyon Creek Condominiums. The applicant's proposing 5,000 square feet of commercial, 79 multifamily units, and of that, 28 units will be workforce housing. Commissioners were asked for some direction on some threshold questions. So since this project's been discussed going back and forth for 4 years, one of those is whether or not it's under the old general plan or the new general plan. How are you guys operating with that?
You know, the way that we left the meeting, we wanted our legal department as well as the applicant to get together and to make that determination as far as does this fall under the new general plan? Does this fall under the old general plan? Does that matter? Either way, as far as being able to move forward with some sort of project on that property that's similar to what they're proposing. So that's pretty much how we left it. We wanted them to come back with us with an answer as far as what we were operating under.
So it seemed to indicate that you're operating under the new general plan. So part of that is a provision there that the county cannot create any new density unless there's a compelling countervailing need. What you heard is that they're planning to create about 18 more workforce units than required to. So I guess the question is that compelling?
Well, and that's what we're trying to decide with this, is the project and the additional workforce housing. And in addition to having some other options for rentals for those that are not below the 80% of the annual median income line, which is also very hard to find in the basin. So that's what we're trying to decide. At this point, we left it that we're interested in looking further into the project to determining exactly which general plan we're operating under and being open to exploring the code and seeing if this will work as an exception for us.
Right. On one hand, the applicant said a dire need for affordable rental housing. On the other hand, you did get some caution from Pat Putt. What was he telling you?
So Pat, he did such a great job, and he was just cautioning us that, yes, affordable housing is important. Clearly, it's very important. However, we want to make sure that we're doing it right, that we're not just throwing units up wherever, but that they have access to services, that it's not going to have these huge impacts that we're not preparing for, that we can't really mitigate, and just moving people that are commuting from Salt Lake to people living on the outskirts of town, commuting into Park City proper or other places in the basin, and still not helping us with our traffic and some of the other issues that we're having.
Okay. Melina, anything else you want to mention?
We really appreciate the efforts that people are putting in for their applications, and especially the staff and all of their efforts. And we have a really great planning commission of volunteers. I really appreciate my other commissioners, but we have a really great staff in the planning department that works very, very hard, and just wanted to just publicly appreciate their efforts as well.
Okay. Melina, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner Melina Steele. Morning. Well, the Park City Council meets in a study session tomorrow starting at 3 o'clock. In the studio with a rundown, I have Park City Manager Diane Faster along with Business License Specialist Beth Benyon and Hannah Tyler, a planner. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
So, Diane, let's start with you at 4:55, a quick update on UDOT's SR 248 plan. Anything new here?
What we're doing here, and the reason why we wanted to talk with the council, was we're moving quickly as possible on SR 248 to be able to open up the park and ride and have an HOV and bus lane, or we don't know exactly what it's going to look like yet, but that's one of the proposals, and I would expect we're going to have something that will get people who carpool or bus in more quickly from 42 into town. Via 248. And one of the things that happened in that process was that some people in the area of the rail trail received a letter, and that is a precursor to starting the whole environmental assessment process. And so there were some concerns and some folks who thought that something was happening to the rail trail. This is an extremely long process, and there's a ton of public input, and it's not my belief that anything's going to happen in the rail trail, but that needs to happen in the process. And so what we wanted to do was take some time and explain a little bit more exactly what their process is, the importance of public involvement in this, and where folks can share that information with UDOT. Remember, this is a federal process, and we'll be getting state and federal money for this, so we absolutely need to follow those processes.
Right, so it's not going to happen on the timeline you had hoped for then. Getting something done soon.
Oh, the timeline, actually, from a transportation perspective and from a road perspective, it's actually incredibly soon. Alfred Knotts was successful in moving this project up by 2 years by working with the state on processes he brought with him from Tahoe. where we're partnering, and the city's actually the lead on this. So it's happening much more quickly than it was scheduled to be, like on the 2022 or 2023 state improvement project list.
Well, I understand that, but mm-hmm. the NEPA process, I don't think you guys were aware. I think that caught you off guard in terms of having to wait 16 months so that this NEPA process could go through.
Actually, Alfred Knotts is quite familiar with NEPA in Tahoe. Anything you do, if you sneeze, you have to do a NEPA process because of the lake. And so I actually don't believe that caught him by surprise at all.
So the city's taking the lead on this, you say, in terms of the design work. Does that mean that taxpayers are paying for what would otherwise be a federal state project?
The city is going to front some money that will be paid back to the city. And actually, to be clear about that process and why it's a little bit rushed is simply because of weather and timing. There are some things we want to be able to get to happen that are happening a little bit more quickly than maybe it would normally take. And that's simply because our team, our transportation planning team, is working with the state as quickly as possible to make this happen because of the importance of it.
So at 5:10, a discussion on the community center design budget and scope. Are we sticking to the $4.5 million budget here?
The budget was actually about 6.2, and that's because we combined a couple budgets on that one. And I would be doubtful if it would be great if we could come in at that budget. I think it's possible if we do some significant value engineering. And I'm not, when we look at what we want for the community, I think the budget's probably going to need to be more. That's ultimately City Council's decision about where they want to go on that. But this facility is primarily to serve seniors and summer day camp, as well as have other flexible community uses. And just what we're seeing with the cost of construction, it's highly unlikely that if we wanted to do what we think is the right thing there, that we could get it for $6.2 million.
So the staff needs some direction then on what council wants to do or what needs to be cut out.
Yes, specifically on that, as well as we're coming back with discussion of the playgrounds and the volleyball courts and things that are around there that are very important to the community, high utilization of those facilities. And we wanted to have a discussion about it's that piece is a much lower cost than the community center, but it's important that we go into this eyes wide open.
During the regular meeting, the council, like the school board already has, and the Summit County Council will today approve a resolution in support of DACA. Why is this important that all of these government agencies are doing this? I mean, the resolution in and of itself does nothing.
Well, first and foremost, Councilmember Nan Worrell, when she heard this, she jumped into action and started talking with the City Council and County Council informally. And because we didn't have a meeting, we were on city tour, she just, you know, checked in with folks and asked if they wanted to do this. As far as what it means, it's a very strong message to our congressional delegation, right, that we don't have the authority to do something on this. And it says to that delegation that this is a community that we value, that we believe we made a promise as a country, and we need to make good on that. Also, with a city that has DACA employees, and DACA isn't something that you report to the Human Resource Department. You simply get a work permit when that happens, and that avoids discrimination. We're hugely supportive of that. But we do know on KPCW, Junior Sanchez, Enrique Sanchez, came on the air and talked about his perspective, and what a great kid. And he works at the MARC. He works at the front desk and also does Latino outreach. And this past weekend, in working with the Park City Community Foundation, Junior was at the St. Mary's Church, along with a lot of other city staff, enrolling Latino students in some of our recreation programs.
Let's see. The Art and Culture District update, the three parties, Park City, Kimball Arts Center, and Sundance Institute, have created a committee. We've got representatives from each of the entities, I guess you and the mayor as a liaison. So we're talking about purchasing this property. What was the price? $19.5
million? $19.5 million.
Yeah. And the city initiating a transit room tax of 1% in January to pay for this. Have you had any blowback on that?
You know, for the lodging community, this is a challenge. This is a logistical challenge just because they've had, you know, we have one property who let us know they had over $1 million on the books for after January. So they have to go back and retroactively do that. Most of them have had the experience of doing that in the past, and I will say it's not easy. And at the same time, the lodging community has maintained huge support for this. So while it is causing them some challenges, and you know, I think they wish, and if it were possible, I think we would have included them earlier in the process. I don't believe it was possible because of the confidentiality requirements. However, at the end of the day, these folks are supportive of this, even though they've got some challenges to it. And I will say we've issued an RFP for a arts and culture consultant who will help us through the entire process to find how can the city help create vibrancy with these two amazing anchors.
The visioning exercises are to be complete by the end of October, groundbreaking by spring of 2019. So what gets built first? I mean, or will we see everybody there? Sundance, Kimball, and the city building, it's retail and housing that it's planning.
We actually don't know the answer to that simply because we haven't started that. What will start before, though, is in October we will issue an RFP for a request for a proposal for a company, likely an architecture company, to come in and do site design. So some of the infrastructure construction will start before then, and also the city and city staff, city attorney's office, as well as Nate Rockwood, the project manager, have been working with the tenants and making sure they know exactly what their timeline is and that they have a clear path.
Okay. Let's turn to Beth and Hannah. The license vesting with the Main Street Business Improvement District. This is actually a work session item being presented during the regular meeting, old business, due to time constraints. But what's the council considering? Beth, do you want to hit that first?
We in licensing are looking at our processes in conjunction with this planning project that they've done. And Hannah can tell you a little bit about the background of the chain ordinance that went into place.
Yeah, so on August 17th, Council adopted the conventional chain business ordinance, and at that meeting they asked us to return with some vesting options as well as a tail. And so what we've brought to them tomorrow night are five different options that, you know, range from eliminating the business license pre-inspection so they could vest as soon as they apply for a business license, to planning maintaining a pool of potential conventional chains. And so we're just looking for some direction. And hopefully we can get some good feedback and move forward with that.
Okay, so that was planning language and licensing language. I mean, what does it mean?
So the current process for business licensing is anything in city limits needs a pre-inspection before we can take the application. So that kind of presents a problem for people who are doing major tenant improvements and construction, and then the licensing comes kind of at the end of that process. So we're putting our heads together with planning to see what would be the best way. We're giving a platter of options to council and see what direction they'd like us to go in.
Okay. Well, of course, last week you saw a lawsuit filed against the ordinance itself. Does that not put all of this on hold, or you just move forward?
You know, I haven't personally been made aware of a lawsuit against the city at this point, and so I don't think we're prepared to comment on it just because we haven't seen it yet.
You haven't been served? Is that what you're saying?
You know, we I don't, as far as yesterday, I wasn't aware that we actually had been served. I had heard who some of the parties might be who were actually claiming to file suit. And, you know, a lot of times people will say, I'm going to sue the city, and then they don't necessarily follow through with it. And even if we do get served, I believe this is something that the city council and the community very much believes in, and I believe we're prepared to defend it.
So with regard to the chain stores, I mean, why is doing something like this important in terms of creating this tail, as you call it, and without having to do a pre-inspection?
So there's been concern that a potential conventional chain business would have to invest a ton of money into a space before they knew that they could actually secure a business license. And so this would hopefully give a potential chain some assurance in the process and that they could then get their funding and things like that.
Okay. Anything else you think people ought to know about that?
No, I think we're just looking for direction, and so we'll move forward with that.
Okay, five options to choose from.
It is, and it's important on this one, too, that people know that this one is a work session. Even though it's scheduled on the regular agenda, we're just super busy these days, as we have been since basically the May timeframe. And but this allows also for public input. And so if folks want to come out. I do want to also just highlight that the there's going to be an application that's published on Friday for the taxi group, and both of Beth is quite involved in that. And this is we're going to want feedback on taxi licensing. And so if folks want to, if you're either a driver or if you're an owner or if you're a customer, we actually want all those groups represented in the committee.
Okay. Beth, Hannah, and Diane, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time 844. Good morning. Well, as we've reported, Old Ranch Road homeowners are complaining about the smell and flies of a home that has farm animals on it. This is in a rural residential zone. So what does that mean? Is it farmland or is it a residential neighborhood? The issue is now being studied by the Summit County Health Department. In the studio, I have Environmental Health Director Phil Bondurant. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what are you been tasked to do with this issue that is it's in the Planning Commission's venue at this point?
Right, and this isn't the first time we've dealt with it. This is the first time we've dealt with it in the basin, but we've encountered the same issues on the east side as well, and it's really an issue of proximity. We don't have a clear definition as to what is allowed by farm animal standards. One pig can create as many flies as 100 pigs if it's not taken care of properly. So we're coming up on a method or using a method that allows us to evaluate whether those farm practices are appropriate based on the state rule and what's included in the health code. And from there, taking the necessary action to correct that. All farms are going to produce flies, are going to produce smells and sounds. And unfortunately, when the zoning doesn't have a clear definition of what is allowed or what's not, we find ourselves trying to find different solutions. And so we're trying to think outside the box on this one and go with a different route that's being used throughout the state. And so we're looking to identify a consultant that we can bring in on an as-needed basis that will provide us with an evaluation that can be used to determine if the best practices are being used or not.
So that's going to be done before any kind of decisions made on this issue here?
That I can't speak to. This situation has been separated into two, unfortunately. The health department's dealing with the smells and the flies and those issues that deal with health. The zoning issue is being handled at a different level. And so regardless of what's decided at the zoning level, the health department still has a priority and a responsibility to take care of these health issues, and that's what we're looking to do.
And what are specifically the health issues? I mean, flies are everywhere.
Correct, they are. And a lot of people they believe that smells are a health issue, and we find ourselves struggling with that as well, because the presence of a smell does not constitute that a disease is present. And that's where we're looking: is it a public health nuisance? And so flies are definitely a nuisance. Flies that come off of manure piles, whether it be, cow manure or if it's mink manure. Flies are flies. And so while flies don't directly transmit disease, they do have the ability as what's called a fomite, in where they have the disease or the bacteria on their legs or on their wings. And when they land on you or land on your food, they have the ability to transfer that. So we don't typically see that too much here in the United States, especially here in the West. But there's always that opportunity. It's proven in literature and research, and so we don't want to take that risk of just ignoring it. Now, that's to say, we can't just base our response off of the presence of flies. Like you said, flies they're everywhere. I mean, flies come off of farms, but flies also come off of dumpsters and everything else. So trying to pin the presence of flies on one lot over another, especially in an area where there's horses and cows and everything else, is really not a good concept moving forward. So that's where we're going around the flies and around the smells and everything else and getting to the root cause of, is this individual that has these farm animals, that's conducting these farm operations, are they using best management practices identified by some of our partners of Utah State University or these different agencies that look at ways that the methods can reduce those flies? And so we're going to bring in a consultant on an as-needed basis, take them out during our inspections, have them do an evaluation, and provide us with their findings. And then from there, based on those findings, We'll use our health code and the authorities that are given to us in that to address the issue and not necessarily be punitive, but say, hey, these are things that A, B, and C can be done differently to reduce flies and essentially reduce the complaints from the neighbors.
What about those old shell fly strips? We don't use those anymore?
We do, but unfortunately some of the neighbors have provided evidence that those fly strips, they fill them up quick. I mean, the flies are out there. And we've had an extremely bad fly year and hornets and bees and everything else this year in the sense that it seems as though there's an abundance of them flying around. And so, you know, there's the argument that, well, we shouldn't have to put up fly strips because of somebody else's actions is probably a valid argument. And that's why the health department's looking at addressing this from the root cause of saying, okay, we agree with you and we agree with the possibility of it being a public health nuisance. So rather than just saying you need to control the flies, but the smells and the activities are still there, we're saying if you control the activities in a responsible manner, the flies and the smells and everything else go away.
Yeah, well, you were saying early on, you know, one pig managed or 100 pigs managed correctly is the same as one pig not managed correctly. So, I mean, what is it? It's just removing the manure quickly? What are...
Yeah, you know, and that's... The farm practices and speaking with some of the locals, the manure has a benefit. A lot of times it can be used. I mean, we put manure on grass to get it to green up in the spring. And so there are benefits. However, there's also a threshold. And as an environmental health scientist, I am not an agricultural person, so I don't know what that threshold is. But that's why we're seeking assistance and guidance outside of the health department, because we don't want to be the ones that provide the false direction or something that's not appropriate that may not allow the farmers to be productive. And so that's why we bring in somebody from USU or somebody outside the valley that doesn't have connections or outside of the county that doesn't have connections that can come in and say, yeah, you know, these are things that they can do and that will reduce the flies. And then as the health department, we use our resources to work with that individual to say, hey, you know, we need you to do these things to reduce the flies, and it still doesn't harm your operation in any matter. Yeah, it may take a little bit extra elbow grease to make that happen. And then if that doesn't happen, then we look more towards a regulatory approach of ensuring that that happens.
So you haven't even hired the consultant yet at this point?
No, we're still working through some of the stuff on the back end. Unfortunately, it's not as easy as I thought it was going to be, but we want to be thorough and make sure that when we do implement this type of approach that it can be effective. I've spoken with a few different consultants and gotten some feedback from them on their role on this. And a lot of them are hesitant because, you know, they're farmers at heart, and so they don't want to do anything that would be considered negative towards their community. But they also understand the benefit that it can provide to the community. So we're working through that. Unfortunately, in all honesty and transparency, I don't think it will be in place this year. So as the Planning Commission looks to determine, you know, farm animal numbers and proximity issues and zoning issues, we hope to have this fully running in the spring so that before next summer we can have some of these issues alleviated.
I'm going to say in the meantime the flies are going to die off anyway.
I mean, it's supposed to get cool off quite a bit tomorrow, and that will, I'm sure the individuals on Old Ranch Road are happy to see that cold front come in and knock some of these flies down, as we are as well. And then I give you my assurances that next spring and summer we'll be in a better position to deal with these issues.
Okay. Hey, Phil, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Summit County Health Environmental Director Phil Bondurant. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:53. Good morning. Well, the National Ability Center this week announced it's launching a capital campaign and has plans to deal with the growth that they have seen in their programs. In the studio with details, I have Gail Brill, the director of NAC, along with Bill Rock, COO of Park City Mountain. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Gail, let's just start with you. You announced a few weeks ago the 50-year lease that Vail Resorts granted you for a home base at the resort. So what's happening here now?
So now, in addition to that, that was one part of our capital campaign. But I have to tell you, this campaign process has been going on for a while. So this is not us just starting this idea. I think it's started about 2013. We've been very diligent as an organization to do a feasibility study, to work with our families and our partners and our supporters to determine what we needed, to put in a plan, to talk to the city, and just kind of work everything in the background. And so we were really proud to announce that we've come up with an amazing plan. When we met with the city several years ago, they said, did you do enough? Are you really thinking about 20 years? This community's growing, the state's growing, we're growing nationally. So we put in a couple other small things, but we're where we want to be. And the total plan is about $15 million. And currently, we've been fundraising for about a year and a half, and we are at just over $11 million.
That's amazing. Yeah. So you've got a couple of different things that you're working with here. Of course, you've got the base out at Quinn's Junction.
Yep.
We'll talk a little bit about that. But then you've also, again, with this 50-year lease, Park City Mountain is going to allow the trailer to come down and giving them some space for a real building.
Yeah, so when I was in here last time, I wasn't able to talk about this capital campaign, but now I'm happy that NAC has announced it. So, yeah, we have a 50-year lease with NAC, and we're thrilled to support such a community institution. And they do great work for not only, you know, people who live here, but also around the country and world. And so our lease and the ability to create a new mountain center, which, yeah, the trailers will go away, which I think no one is sad about, and support this incredible program. It's a great opportunity for us, you know, stability for the program. It's a long-term commitment so they could plan for the future, and we're thrilled to partner with NAC.
So you're giving them property then on which to build something?
Yeah, it's basically a lease of a parcel that we've analyzed that's buildable, suits their needs, close to the base area that, you know, is a 50-year lease and is basically a donation.
Yeah, nice. So where is it?
So we are thrilled. It is kind of right below where we are, where those two magic carpets are. We're thrilled for Epic Promise and Vail Resorts and Park City Mountain, certainly, to have made this commitment. I believe one of our kids who's in a power chair, if you know what a power chair is, they're pretty big and bulky. He said that our mountain center is worse than any high school hallway he's ever been in. We've had that facility for way too long and really outgrown it many years ago. So part of this build is just to catch up where we are. And the other part is to use that facility year-round to really – we've had a growing mountain bike program, a hiking program, our camps program that can operate out of that facility in the summertime too.
So just to kind of locate me, it's going to be near the first time chairlift there. Where the ski patrol is or further up?
No, further uphill, closer to the Village Lodge, so where those carpets are on the – as you look uphill on the left. So we'll probably – actually, I think we have to relocate a couple of those carpets, move a little snowmaking infrastructure. But it's a great spot. It provides all the, you know, snow access that NAC needs, plus – you know, access to the from the parking lot into the building. So we're excited about it, and it'll dress that area up a bit too.
Yeah, so will you be able to maybe build up and then use some of that for any needs you have?
Yeah, no, right now we don't have any plans to share the space, and so it's all NAC space, and we're happy to see them get started.
Yeah, we are going to fill it out for sure. One of the greatest features that we were really strong advocates for is the ability to push people right out onto the snow and have them come out. So if you can, again, picture in our mountain center currently, it takes us, 20 minutes on average to get someone set in a sit chair or some sort of a mono ski or a bi ski. And then we have to transfer them back into their wheelchair where they get out to the snow and then go ahead and transfer them back into that chair, pat them all up again, another, 10 minutes. And we really wanted the ability to be more efficient and get people, especially those who have trouble managing their own temperatures, in and out of the building as quickly as possible. So that's huge. There are things like a sensory room, if you've ever been in our mountain center again, current double wide trailer. It is super loud. It is not the best place for those on the autism spectrum or with other sensory issues. We have a space now that they can be comfortable and get fitted in appropriate comfort and quiet.
So that's going to be at the mountain, and then you also have plans then to expand what you've got out at Quinn's?
Yeah, we have a number of projects there, about six projects in total, many of them being additions to where we already have space. So in addition to our equestrian facility, an improvement to our climbing wall in our programs building, and then a couple of new and innovative programs and spaces. So one is a campground, a little mini campground. And I wasn't sure. We brought it to the city again years ago as we were examining this. Would this be a good fit? And, you know, the families, the donors, they all got really excited, the state of Utah, about this. So camping is one of those top recreational things that gets people outside. And what we didn't realize, but of course my amazing staff knew intuitively, that so many families just don't do that because they're afraid, well, they have the resources they need. So this is a teaching campground, teaching you how to camp, and then it'll be linked to state parks, national parks, and BLM opportunities across the state to go camping.
I didn't realize that you had a more allowed density, though, at the Quinn's facility.
We do. We've been in an ongoing process with the city. We're an MPD process, and they've been really great to work with. We do. It has been a long process, so we look forward to wrapping that MPD process up this seasoned before the end of the year. Also, moving forward on the Mountain Center, unanimously, the Mountain Center was determined as the number one priority for our organization.
Okay, so we'll see that come through the planning process here shortly.
Yep, and I would say if anyone's interested, certainly come out for a tour. We're always available. Check our website. There's more information there at discovernac.org. And a little plug, we are a people organization and we need a lot of people. And we are low right now for our ski and snowboard instructors, volunteer and staff. And so just a little plug for the community to get involved there too. But this is a long process. These buildings aren't going to pop up tomorrow. Come out and celebrate with us as we go through this process over the next several years.
Okay. Gail, Bill, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
KPCW News Time, 9 o'clock.